You know, when you walk into your kitchen first thing in the morning, and you turn on the tap, you just expect clear, clean water to come pouring out.
Right. You definitely don't stand there visualizing the municipal reservoir.
No, exactly. Or, the miles of underground pipes or the chemical filtration systems that make it safe. You just want a drink of water.
Yeah, you don't care about the plumbing until it breaks.
Right, because if like brown sludge suddenly comes pouring out of that faucet, well, everything changes. All of a sudden, you care a whole lot about the plumbing.
You really do.
You want to know exactly how that water is being processed, where it's coming from, and who is actually responsible for keeping the contaminants out.
And I mean, that is just the perfect way to look at our modern information ecosystem. For a long time, we just kind of assumed the infrastructure of the news worked quietly in the background.
Yeah, like the pipes were just doing their job.
Exactly. But right now, millions of people are opening their phones, turning on their personal information taps, and feeling like they're getting nothing but sludge.
It's overwhelming.
It is. They're overwhelmed, they're suspicious, and frankly, they're desperate to understand how the plumbing is actually supposed to work.
So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are promising you a shortcut to becoming exceptionally well-informed about the very information you consume every single day.
Yeah, we've got some fascinating material today.
We really do. We're looking at a massive, newly published institutional report. It's titled The Essence of Journalism, and it was just put together by the American newspaper and American TV.
It's a really comprehensive look at the industry.
Right. And our mission for this deep dive is to pull up the floorboards and examine that hidden architecture. We are going to explore how raw, chaotic reality is supposed to be transformed into the verified public knowledge we rely on.
And why that entire system is currently in a state of digital crisis, which is the really pressing part.
Yes, absolutely. And just to set the ground rules right up front for you listening, this is not about taking political sides.
No, not at all.
We aren't here to bash the media, and we aren't here to play defense for specific news outlets either. We are simply taking an impartial look under the hood to give you a framework for how the machine operates, based strictly on the mechanics outlined in this report.
Right, because to understand why the machine feels so broken to you right now, we actually have to step back and redefine what the machine was built to do in the first place.
Which seems basic, but it's really not.
It isn't. The biggest, probably most dangerous misconception out there is that journalism is basically just a megaphone for events.
Like someone just shouting the news.
Exactly. That a reporter is just someone standing on a street corner yelling, "Hey, this thing just happened."
I mean, I'm guilty of thinking of it like a mirror. You hear that phrase all the time, that the news is just a mirror reflecting society back at itself.
Yeah, that's a really common analogy.
Right, and if the reflection in the mirror is ugly or confusing or just full of screaming politicians, well, isn't that just a reflection of reality? Like, why blame the mirror?
Well, the report specifically tackles that mirror defense using a philosophical perspective. They argue that reality is actually far too complex for a simple mirror.
How so?
Well, if you hold up a mirror to a bustling city, you don't get understanding. You just get a chaotic blur of movement and noise.
Oh, that makes sense. You just see the chaos.
Exactly. So instead, the report defines journalism as an epistemic method.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second. Epistemic method sounds like something from, I don't know, a graduate philosophy seminar.
Fair point. It is a bit academic. But epistemology is simply the study of how we know what we know. So an epistemic method is a systematic, disciplined way of gathering knowledge. It means journalism isn't just passively reflecting what it sees, it actively processes it.
So it's doing work on the raw information.
Yes, it filters information, it tests incoming claims against hard evidence, and crucially, it makes uncertainty visible.
Wait, what do you mean by making uncertainty visible?
Well, a good reporter separates what they actually observed with their own eyes from what they are merely inferring. They take uncertain, messy social reality and run it through a method to produce verified contextual knowledge.
So it's an active processing plant, not a passive reflection. But that brings up a massive structural paradox that the text highlights.
The economic one.
On one hand, journalism has this incredibly noble civic purpose. It exists to give citizens the information they need to preserve collective self-government.
Which is foundational to democracy.
Right. But on the other hand, it has to accomplish that democratic mission while surviving in a ruthless capitalist commercial market. It has to sell attention to keep the lights on.
And that economic tension is really the defining struggle of the industry. I mean, a newsroom has to sell subscriptions and
They
advertising.
have to pay their staff.
Exactly. but its entire legitimacy requires that it never lets those market forces dictate its editorial judgment.
Which is a tough tightrope to walk.
It is. The report has this great visual figure one, where it shows journalism sitting right in the center of the public sphere.
Like the hub of a wheel.
Yeah, think of it as the vital infrastructure linking regular citizens to massive corporate markets and linking government institutions back to the people.
But sitting in the dead center of the public sphere means you are constantly colliding with the people who actually want to control that reality, right?
Oh, inevitably.
Because if your job is to turn complex events into public knowledge, you are inevitably going to step on the toes of the powerful.
Yes, and the relationship between journalism and power is fascinating because it is completely contradictory. The report describes it as simultaneously adversarial, dependent, and symbiotic.
Okay, I am struggling to see the line there. Yeah. Symbiotic implies they are feeding off each other in a, you know, mutually beneficial way.
Right.
But if your job relies on getting powerful politicians or corporate CEOs to leak you internal documents, aren't you inevitably going to start writing stories that favor those people just to keep your information pipeline open?
That's the trap.
Doesn't that just make you a public relations arm for the government or the corporation?
You've just identified what the report calls the danger of access. And it is a trap that many fall into. Power actually needs journalists, believe it or not.
Except that their message out.
Exactly. Politicians need them to float trial balloons like, to anonymously leak a policy idea just to see how the public reacts before they officially commit to it.
Oh, that makes sense.
They need the media to shape their legitimacy. But journalists desperately need power too. They need the interviews, the background briefings, the leaked memos to figure out what is actually happening behind closed doors.
But the text warns about this, right?
Yes, it warns that without strict oversight, this dependency leads to capture. A reporter relying entirely on one high-level source will slowly, almost unconsciously, begin to internalize that source's worldview.
So how does a newsroom prevent that capture? I mean, if the reporter is that close to the source, who stops it?
That is where the institution comes in, specifically the editor. A mature newsroom builds distance into its structure.
An institutional distance.
Right. An editor's entire job is to look at a leaked document brought in by a reporter and ask the cynical questions.
What?
Like, who benefits from this leak? Why are they giving this to us today? What are they intentionally leaving out? That distance is the absolute foundation of the watchdog function.
And I want to highlight a crucial distinction the report makes about that watchdog role, because it explicitly states that good journalism is not anti-government or anti-business.
Which is a massive misconception.
It really is. Good journalism is specifically anti-unaccountable power.
Yes. And true scrutiny isn't about theatrical hostility either.
Right, because we see a lot of performative confrontation on cable news or, you know, in press briefing rooms.
All the time. Reporters yelling the loudest to get a viral video clip of themselves basically destroying a politician.
Yeah, that makes for great social media content.
It does, but the report argues that isn't watchdog journalism at all. That's just entertainment.
So what does the actual watchdog function look like, according to figure two in the report?
The true watchdog function is methodical. It relies on pulling public records, analyzing massive data sets, cultivating reluctant sources, and finding eyewitnesses.
So it's not glamorous.
Not at all. It is slow, deliberate, democratic maintenance.
But if a reporter's access to powerful people makes them that vulnerable to manipulation, how do they avoid just becoming a pawn in someone else's PR game?
They need a mechanism to test what they're being told.
Right, because you can't just operate on gut instinct when you are dealing with a seasoned political operative or a corporate spin doctor. They will outmaneuver you.
Absolutely. So you need a bulletproof method. Truthfulness requires process, not just confidence. And this is where the report outlines a concept they call the verification funnel.
Figure three.
Yes, figure three. It visualizes how a raw, messy piece of information actually becomes established truth.
I really love the visualization of a funnel here.
It works perfectly, doesn't it?
It does. You start at the very top, the widest part, with a raw claim. Maybe it's a rumor, an anonymous tip, or, you know, a viral social media post.
Right. Something totally unverified.
Exactly. Then you force that claim down to the next level. Source mapping and context. Who exactly is saying this, and what is their motivation?
Why are they telling you this right now?
Yeah. Then you squeeze it down even further to the hard evidence phase. You demand documents, financial data, or on-the-record witnesses to actually back up the claim.
And then comes the narrowest, most vital step in that funnel, right before publication.
Which is?
Adversarial checking and the right of reply.
Oh, right.
You do not just find a leaked document that makes a corporation look terrible and instantly hit publish to get the web traffic.
Which is what a lot of digital outlets are tempted to do.
Constantly. But a real journalist goes directly to that corporation, presents the evidence they've gathered,
yeah,
and gives them a chance to respond.
So you stress test the information against the very people who have the most to lose from it?
Exactly. And only after surviving all of those steps does the information emerge from the bottom of the funnel as a clear, attributed, and accountable report.
This process ties directly into two core values. The report synthesizes from groups like the Society of Professional Journalists and the Reuters Trust Principles.
Yes, and they tackle two words that are massively misunderstood by the general public.
Objectivity and neutrality.
Right. People hear objective journalism and they think it means a robot wrote it.
Yeah, they think objectivity means having no human perspective, no personal background, and no opinions whatsoever, which is literally impossible for a human being.
The report calls it the myth of the view from nowhere. A journalist is a person with a background, an upbringing, and personal biases. You can't erase that.
No.
So the report clarifies that objectivity is not a state of being. It is a method of disciplined verification.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the best analogy for this is actually a science lab.
Oh, I like that comparison.
Yeah. Objectivity in journalism is exactly like the scientific method. Think about a scientist running a clinical trial. That scientist might desperately want their hypothesis to be true.
Sure, they might want to cure a disease and win a Nobel Prize.
Exactly. They are deeply humanly biased. But the process they use, the double-blind study, the rigorous peer review, the control groups, is specifically designed to strip away their personal desires and leave only the provable, reproducible result.
The method is objective, not the human running the experiment.
Exactly.
That perfectly encapsulates what the text is saying. Objective reporting means resisting your own wishful thinking and being willing to make evidence-based corrections when the facts contradict your initial assumption.
And they pair that method with a critical redefinition of neutrality, right?
Yes. Neutrality simply means a newsroom is not functioning as a partisan instrument for a political party. It means you aren't carrying water for a specific campaign.
But the report drops a massive caveat here, which is that neutrality does not mean moral paralysis.
Right. You don't just stand there doing nothing.
Exactly. Journalism should never be neutral between a documented harm and a denial of that harm. The classic journalism school example is, if one person says it's pouring rain outside and another person says it's perfectly sunny, your job isn't to neutrally quote both of them and tell the reader to decide.
No, your job is to open the window and check the weather.
Right. You verify. You find out who is lying and you report the truth. So we have this elegant, almost scientific method for verifying reality.
The funnel works.
Yeah, the funnel works. The ethical values are sound.
They are.
Then why does my smartphone feel like a toxic wasteland?
The million-dollar question.
Seriously, we have this beautiful intellectual framework, but when you or I open a social media app right now, we are bombarded with misinformation, screaming influencers, and absolute chaos. How did the plumbing get so polluted?
Well, we have undergone a massive, unprecedented platform shift.
Okay, break that down.
Historically, media formats created very specific societal routines. Newspapers created the routine of the morning edition, which was built on public records coverage and maintaining professional archives.
People had a shared baseline of facts.
Exactly. Even broadcast television created a sense of national simultaneity. Everyone was watching the same evening news anchor at the same time, operating from that shared baseline.
But the digital age crisis completely dismantled that.
It shattered it. We shifted heavily to social media and video platforms. And the report notes that these networks reward entirely different psychological triggers.
Like what?
Let's focus on video platforms for a second. They shift authority away from institutions and toward personalities.
Mm.
They rely heavily on parasocial trust.
Oh, let's clarify what that feels like to a user, because that's huge. Parasocial trust is when you watch a specific YouTuber or a TikTok creator every single day.
Right.
You hear about their life, you see their bedroom in the background, and your brain starts to literally process them as an actual real-life friend.
Even though you've never met them.
Yeah. So when they suddenly pivot to giving you a breakdown of a complex geopolitical conflict, you trust their take implicitly. Far more than you would trust a faceless article from an established newspaper.
Exactly, because they feel authentic to you.
Right.
But these platforms don't reward methodical verification. They reward pacing, authenticity, and, unfortunately, exaggeration and absolute emotional certainty.
Yeah.
The core of this crisis, and this is figure four in the report, is algorithmic gatekeeping.
Algorithmic gatekeeping.
Yes. In the past, you had human editors sitting between the newsrooms and the public. Those editors made subjective judgments based on what they believed was publicly important for citizens to know.
And now?
Now, a mathematical algorithm sits in that exact spot.
And think about how an algorithm actually functions. It doesn't have a conscience.
No.
It doesn't care about democracy or civic duty. It is just an equation optimizing for one primary metric, time on screen.
Yes. Just wants your attention.
Because attention equals advertising revenue. If an algorithm shows you a nuanced, deeply researched 5,000-word article about local zoning laws, you might read it, feel informed, and put your phone down.
And then the platform loses money.
Exactly. But if it shows you a 30-second video of someone screaming about how those zoning laws are a massive conspiracy to destroy your neighborhood, you get angry.
You comment. You share it.
Yeah. Stay on the app.
The algorithm incentivizes outrage. Because outrage drives engagement.
It's toxic.
It is. And the report backs this up with some stark realities. Looking at 2025 and 2026, data from the Reuters Institute and the Pew Research Center, the symptoms of this algorithmic environment are severe.
What's the biggest symptom?
First, there's a desperate race for breaking news. Digital speed creates immense pressure on journalists to publish before the verification funnel is actually complete.
Oh, because if you wait a day to get a comment from a source,
you lose the algorithm's favor entirely, and someone else gets the traffic. Speed over accuracy.
And the economic fallout of that is devastating, especially for local news, right?
Yes. The digital advertising dollars that used to fund local reporters covering City Hall completely moved to the tech platforms.
The Reuters Institute 2025 report highlights stagnating digital subscriptions across the board and chronically low public trust.
And the Pew data from 2025 and 2026 shows a terrifying trend. Audiences are actively avoiding the news.
Wait, they're just tuning out?
Yes, massive news avoidance. Why? Because of emotional fatigue.
Oh, that makes total sense.
Right. The algorithmic pacing makes the news feel like a relentless barrage of stress and negativity without any resolution.
Add to that the absolute flood of synthetic AI-generated media confusing the landscape, and people simply shut down. They turn off the tap entirely.
They do.
Which presents the ultimate David versus Goliath battle of our time. You have a slow, careful, verified investigative report trying to compete against a highly monetized, emotionally optimized piece of fake outrage generated by AI.
It's an unfair fight.
How does the institution of journalism survive that? And maybe more importantly, how do you, the listener, protect your own mind in this environment?
Well, the survival guide in the report approaches this from both sides. Let's look at figure five. For the industry side, newsrooms have to radically rebuild their architecture around undeniable public value.
Because the old model is gone.
Exactly. General commodity news, you know, the kind of journalism that just rewrites a press release or summarizes what happened 5 minutes ago, is dead.
It's obsolete.
It will be completely automated by AI or just ignored by audiences.
So to survive, they need defensible value.
Yes. The report argues they need relentless verification discipline, diverse revenue streams so they aren't held hostage by a single platform's algorithm, and serious AI literacy.
They have to provide specialized, deeply reported local and investigative work that a language model simply cannot hallucinate into existence.
Exactly. But the report doesn't just put the burden on the newsrooms.
Right, there's Section 13.
Yes. There is an entire section acting as a direct toolkit for the reader. For you, listening right now, it is a guide on how to evaluate the information flowing through your feed.
I love this part. The very first step they recommend is identify the genre.
Crucial step.
Yeah. When you click a link or watch a video, ask yourself what you're actually consuming. Is this a factual explainer? Is it a partisan opinion column? Is it straight reporting? Or is it an influencer just giving commentary?
Because so much of the modern toxic sludge happens when a reader expects a fiery opinion piece to behave like objective, straight reporting.
You have to know what room you are walking into.
Exactly. The second tool is looking for context and proportion.
Does the story give events their real statistical scale?
Right. Or is it inflating a minor, localized incident into a massive national crisis?
Yeah.
Purely to manufacture attention.
Which happens constantly. Third, and maybe the most critical for your mental health, watch for emotional manipulation.
Yes.
If you read a headline and you feel an instant involuntary surge of anger, fear, or disgust, you need to pause.
Take a breath.
Ask yourself if the actual facts in the body of the article justify that extreme emotion, or if the headline was specifically engineered to trigger your fight or flight response just so you would click and share it.
It's usually the latter. Finally, check for corrections.
Oh, this one is so interesting.
It's incredibly counterintuitive for most people today. We have been conditioned to think that changing your mind is a weakness.
Right.
But the report argues that a newsroom that openly admits its mistakes and clearly explains how they happened is a deeply accountable organization.
Because a source that claims they are never wrong isn't more trustworthy. They are just less transparent.
Exactly. Admitting an error is proof that the verification funnel is actually actively functioning.
So critical reading doesn't mean becoming deeply cynical. A lot of people think being media literate means assuming everything is a lie and trusting no one.
Which is dangerous.
Yeah, blanket cynicism is just another lazier form of manipulation. True critical reading means assigning your confidence based on actual verifiable evidence.
It means building a mental firewall to filter the sludge yourself.
Yes. It requires becoming an active, conscious participant in your own information diet, rather than a passive recipient of whatever the algorithm decides to feed you today.
It really is the only way forward.
So, to synthesize everything we've unpacked today, the platform era has undoubtedly made finding the truth harder. The algorithms are loud, they are fast, and the economic incentives for generating outrage are incredibly strong.
Very strong.
But the core method of journalism, that disciplined epistemic process of finding out, testing claims, contextualizing events, and transparently correcting errors, that method remains our absolute best defense against propaganda, rumor, and unaccountable power.
It is the invisible infrastructure that keeps the public sphere functional, even when the surface feels completely chaotic.
Which brings me to a final lingering thought for you to take away from this deep dive.
Okay.
Early on in the text, the report notes that journalism has always been the first draft of public memory. It creates the physical archives that historians will eventually use to understand our era.
Right, the historical record.
But think about the digital age we are living in at this exact moment.
Uh-huh.
We are flooded with AI-generated text, vanishing hyperlinks, paywalls, and algorithmic social feeds that literally disappear into the ether the moment you refresh your page.
It's ephemeral.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what happens to that public memory? 100 years from now, when future historians try to look back at the 2020s, what will they actually find?
That's a chilling question.
Will they see an era of unmatched, globally connected human knowledge? Or will they look into our archives and find an absolute void of verifiable truth buried under mountains of digital noise?
Wow.
It is something to seriously think about the next time you decide whether to hit share on an article or just scroll past. The next time you turn on your information tap, take a moment to remember the plumbing. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We respect your time, we appreciate your curiosity, and we'll see you next time.